My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And we're very happy today. I'll introduce Anthony in more detail in a moment, to have Anthony DeStefanis here to talk about the Ludlow Massacre, among other things. Let me introduce Anthony and tell you why I think that it's so exciting that Anthony is here. He drove up today from Columbus, Ohio, which is not a small feat, especially he ran into that phenomenon that all of us have run into one time or another on the expressway, where for some reason all traffic stops, but there's no reason that all traffic has stopped. So he ran into that a couple of times on US 23. And all of us know that that is the worst road in both Michigan and in Ohio. But, you know, we're coming up on the anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre, just like we're coming up on the anniversary of the Calumet Copper Strike. Both strikes in 1913-14 were significant events in the history of their states, in the history of the region, and I would argue in the history of the United States. Calumet does not make as much press as Ludlow does.
Oh, yeah. Though it should.
But it should.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about Ludlow, though, is a couple of other things by way of announcement in terms of foreground.
I want to take a couple of these.
Which is that it's interesting that Ludlow was the first strike that I'm aware
Thank
of,
you.
And Anthony, help me with this, I think this is true, where major archaeological digs were done in relation to the strike. There's two now, Ludlow and Blair Mountain in Appalachia. And the reason in both cases is they were very interested both in the tent villages in relation to
yep.
Ludlow,
mm-hmm.
but they were also interested in the amount of lead in those, in both cases, that is the ordnance that was used on both sides. In relation to that, and archaeological digs do a great job for you in terms of being able really to understand the site and what actually happened there. But Ludlow also has a troubled heritage. The monument to the Ludlow victims has been defaced a number of times. Heads have been taken off of the actual figurines on the memorial. And I think, and Anthony can help me with this in a few minutes, I'm sure, that Colorado, I believe that the workers in Colorado were able to get a law passed that the militia could not, National Guard could not appear in uniform, or I'm not sure what but there was for a long time on the books in Colorado a very strong reaction in law to the Ludlow Massacre. So let me tell you a little bit about Anthony DeStefanis. He's currently a professor at Otterbein College in Columbus, Ohio. He finished his PhD in 2004 at William & Mary and did an undergraduate degree prior to that at Rhode Island College. The talk is taken from his manuscript currently in progress, Guarding the Empire, Soldier Strikebreakers on the Long Road to the Ludlow Massacre. And today, he's speaking on one part of that, Creating a Killer, the Colorado National Guard, U.S. Empire, and the Ludlow Massacre. So please join me in welcoming Anthony DeStefanis.
Thanks, and thanks for that introduction, John, and thank you all for coming out on what is a gorgeous day outside. Very much a work in progress. That, as John described, that this is part of manuscript that I want to soon send back to the University of Illinois Press. But what I've got here and this piece that I'm working on is new for me, and so I'm kind of working through these issues in what I'm going to present to you today. First, I guess some background on this strike, if it's not one that you're intimately familiar with. Lasted from the late September of 1913 all the way to the December of 1914. It's generally considered to be one of the most violent strikes in U.S. history. what it's most known for is this Ludlow massacre that happened on April the 20th of 1914. What the take that you get on Ludlow, this is still true in American history textbooks, is that the National Guard attacked this tent colony that the United Mine Workers of America, the union that had organized these coal miners in southern Colorado, they get thrown out of company housing when they went on strike. And so this was something that the UMW had started doing in West Virginia, the building of tent colonies when workers went on strike. So that the National Guard attacked the tent colony. It's more complicated than that, as maybe you might imagine, but that the battle at Ludlow that led to this massacre really developed out of kind of a bizarre set of misunderstandings that happened between the National Guard on one side, the miners on the other, and that those misunderstandings could really only have developed in the kind of really poisoned atmosphere, right? In relationship that the miners on one side and the National Guard on the other side had by April of 1914. The other thing I think that gets lost in this strike too is that by the time the Ludlow massacre happened, this strike was over. That the mining companies led by Colorado Fuel and Iron, which was owned by the Rockefeller family, that they had by April of 1914 had brought in more than enough non-union workers to take the place of the people who are on strike. And so that kind of, you know, adds to the tragedy of the Ludlow massacre. The union kept going with the strike after Ludlow, in part because there's no way the miners would have given up on it, right, after the battle and the killings that happened at Ludlow. So to give you a sense of this, right? So first in Colorado, this is where it happened down here in Huerfano and Las Animas counties. There were kind of two coal fields in Colorado. The largest, most productive one was down here. There's another one up north of Denver here in Weld County. The mining industry had gotten off the ground in the 1870s, the Rockefeller family bought Colorado Fuel and Iron in 1903. Colorado Fuel and Iron, just to give you a sense of that company, was on the list of the 100 biggest corporations in the country in 1913. It was the biggest corporation west of the Mississippi River. It was the largest employer of people in the state of Colorado. And the southern coal field down here was kind of the largest coal field in the West, and so important for the railroad development, right, and the providing of fuel for the railroads. Colorado Fuel and Iron also owned and operated a steel mill in Pueblo. And so a good deal of the coal is kind of at least partially a captive set of mines that CF&I ran to provide the coal to make coke for the for their steel mill. You get a sense of the Ludlow tent colony. At its height, during the strike, about 1,200 people lived in the tent colony. So miners and their families built the tent colony, and Ludlow was the largest of 11 different tent colonies that the UMW constructed at the outset of the strike, Ludlow being the largest one. So put it up as the strike was getting off the ground. The winter of 1913-1914 was one of the snowiest on record in Colorado, and so it made life in the tent colony, you could see snow on the ground, all the more challenging during this strike. tense family. This picture makes me think that kids in the early 20th century came with a little stand that you hold them on. So the tent colony, I mean, it operated like a little city. What's that?
It looks like a school.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. That they did the best they can with making life as kind of normal as they could during the strike. There were, 24 different languages spoken among the people who participated in the strike, who went on strike. And so as a recent scholarship on this strike, if you're familiar with Scott Martel's book or Thomas Andrews' book, it really emphasizes kind of the degree of class solidarity that these people were able to establish across, you know, ethnic and racial lines. Tense. And so the battle at Ludlow lasted for pretty much the entire day on April 20th, 1914. It started at about 9 o'clock in the morning and wasn't until the early evening that the Colorado National Guard fought its way into the tent colony and proceeded to burn it down. Aftermath of it. See here, pit. There were more than a few tents that people had dug holes, had dug pits into the earthen floor of their tent, and it's been used for a number of different things, but the primary use for the pits was, this was a hiding place. That at the outset of this strike, the mining companies hired the Baldwin-Felts Detective Agency to help them break this strike. If you're familiar with Matewan, John Sayles' movie on the 1920 coal mining strike in West Virginia, Baldwin-Felts got its start in West Virginia as a detective agency that, you know, private companies that did strike breaking. And Baldwin-Felts was, and of the many companies by the early 20th century that did this, that Baldwin-Felts' reputation was being one of the more brutal of these companies. So if you wanted your strike broken violently, then the people to hire were Baldwin-Felts. And so one of the things that they did, and Sales has a scene on this in Matewan. I think that I have it in here. I didn't put it in here. I think I actually took it out. Should have left it in. Albert Feltz, who was one of the brothers who owned the company, he outfitted a Model A Ford with armored plating that was made at the CFNI's Pueblo Steel Mill. And mounted a machine gun on the back of it, and it's kind of vehicle that they drove around. It's kind of technology, right, of intimidation, and used it on a number of occasions to shoot into the tent colonies. The idea being to provoke a reaction, a violent reaction from the miners. Strategy being then to get the governor of Colorado, who actually was, his name is Elias Ammons, is a Democrat and elected in 1912, actually with labor's support, and so he's kind of hesitant to call out the National Guard. But the strategy was to create violence, to give the governor no choice, right, but to send the National Guard to southern Colorado to restore order. So pits were places to hide from Baldwin-Felts' bullets. And so there were 11 children and three women who went into this particular pit. That's really early in the day on April 20th, and we're there for much of the day, and when the National Guard fought its way into the tent colony and burned the tent that was over this pit, that fire sucked the oxygen out of the pit, and two of the women and all 11 children were suffocated and died. And so it's these women and children, kind of what, you know, leads, right, people to start to call this the Ludlow Massacre, the deaths of these women and children. This was not the first time that the Colorado National Guard had been called on to break a strike. Colorado legislature formed its National Guard in 1879, just 3 years after Colorado achieved statehood. 1879 is also significant in that it's 2 years after the 1877 Nationwide Railroad strike, and what's significant there is that in that 1877 strike that was ultimately put down by the U.S. Army, the local militias that existed at the time and that were called out, starting in West Virginia where the 1877 strike began, just weren't very effective at putting down that strike. Those militias were established with the Second Amendment to the Constitution that we fight a whole heck of a lot about, right, is what it means, but the stipulation in the Second Amendment about a well-regulated militia, right, that's those were the militias that were called out in 1877. By 1877, however, they were not well or regulated. They hardly existed, right? So in the aftermath of 1877, what state officials and business leaders did was to get together and kind of think about the feeling after the 1877 strike was that this was going to continue, right? That America was entering this period of class warfare and that it needed a more effective strike-breaking force on hand. And so the National Guard system, and the one that we, you know, that we still have today, that it has grown from, was established after 1877 explicitly, consciously as a strike-breaking force, to have a more effective strike-breaking force on hand. So more broadly, the National Guards across the country, you could say, were part of the very formidable strike-breaking and union-busting arsenal that capital wielded against labor during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that the National Guards certainly deserved their place alongside the private detective agencies, the court injunctions, the importation of strike-breakers across state and national boundaries, that employers used against labor. A historian of the National Guards named Jerry Cooper found that, did this counting for me, which has been nice. National Guards were called out in a neighborhood of 250 times between 1877 and 1946. This is the shaggy dog of a story. In the aftermath of 1877, you get, it's kind of, you know, business people and state officials, particularly in industrial states, getting together and starting to think about, you know, how to have a more effective strike-breaking force on hand. The Army was not interested in doing this. They had other fish to fry at this point. They're still fighting Indians. Posse Comitatus Act was passed in 1878 in the aftermath of Reconstruction that made the ability of the Army to operate inside of the boundaries of the United States that much more difficult. And so you've got these militias out there that were attached to states and localities that were not very well functioning. In the aftermath of the Civil War in particular, what you also had were these kind of voluntary militias that men put together as kind of social organizations, right, as fraternal organizations, people who are interested in things military. And there was kind of a vibrancy that existed in those volunteer militias that certainly didn't exist in the ones that were attached to states and to localities. they acted, they kind of operated as fraternal organizations, and so what you had is a kind of coming together of, for the most part, middle and upper class men. And so they start to say to state officials, you know, we can do this, right? And business folks were comfortable with them given the class background that they came from. And so they kind of start to take those voluntary militias and attach them to the state formally to make them the state's National Guard. This first happens in Pennsylvania, is the first state to do this, and then you get a kind of succession of industrial states that also established the National Guard in this way. By the early 20s, it's in 1903 that the National Guards become the kind of formal reserve system for the Army. But that doesn't happen until 1903. Okay, it did quite a lot of strike breaking. At the same time, though, that labor historians and other folks who have looked at kind of the relationship between capital, labor, and the state, military historians as well, they've not spent a lot of time on trying to explain, right? The dynamics of strike breaking, of military strike breaking, that we know that the National Guards broke a lot of strikes. One of the things that we don't know much about is why National Guards were, for such a long period of time, so kind of willing, right, to and eager to break strikes. Think about, and it's something I'll talk about as I go, the kind of class dynamics here often an officer class that was middle and upper class, but then enlisted men were overwhelmingly working class. I think what we have right now, that what historians have right now, is a kind of simple explanation for why the National Guards acted as they did, that they were kind of simply the tools of capital. Given the amount of influence that capital had over the state in this period, that they were able to kind of access, right, the military wing of the state. What I want to suggest here is that, well, more complicated than that. It's true, and as I said, that the Guards Officer Corps was made up almost entirely middle and upper class men, and they certainly, in the case of Colorado, that they shared class sympathies and class interests with the mine operators in southern Colorado. They pointed out the Colorado National Guard did do quite a bit of strike breaking. But it also began its life back in 1879 fighting the Plains Indians, that the conquest of the West wasn't over yet. In Colorado. And so Colorado National Guard, upon its establishment, spent a couple of decades, actually, fighting the Plains Indians from the late 1870s through the decade and a half, through the early 1890s. And you kind of see in histories that officers wrote of the National Guard in Colorado, it's just kind of like the legacy of Western conquest was very strong, right, within the National Guard. That they, and military organizations often, and it was the case with this National Guard, they have a very kind of strong sense of their own history, that they know what the units that they're attached to have done in the past, and so forth. The officer corps in particular, I think, came to see strike breaking as a continuation of the Guards' frontier era efforts to spread civilization across the continent. Guards' estimation, these workers in southern Colorado were primarily southern and eastern European immigrants, got some Hispanos and Mexican immigrants mixed in as well. And that what they're kind of doing is kind of equating, right, this racialized group of immigrants with the Plains Indians. It's also the case that a lot of these guys had served in the Philippines as well, and so had in both cases, right, in on the plains and in the Philippines, kind of an experience of fighting a racially other enemy. And so you kind of see them equating, right? New immigrant workers and strikers with these former enemies. Like the Plains Indians and kind of, you know, Filipino insurrectionists who had resisted U.S. imperial conquest, Guardsmen saw Southern and Eastern European immigrants that they faced during this strike as kind of racially inferior savages, and this is the language that they use, and I'll get further into that as we go. When the Colorado National Guard's Adjutant General, a man named John Chase, for example, wrote that Southern Colorado's striking coal miners possessed a quiet, savage hatred, he expressed a perception common among guardsmen who served during this strike, during the 1913-14 strike. I think that this portrayal of the striking miners resonated strongly because it at once kind of conjured up the Old West by portraying guardsmen as defenders of white Anglo civilization, while it also reflected kind of nativist thinking about the racial inferiority of new immigrants that had become so prevalent by the 1910s. So it's like this way in which they're kind of looking backward to the Old West, and they're taking something that comes out of the kind of the modern world of the early 20th century, this kind of scientific racism, right? So to get at this and to get further into it, I want to examine the National Guard's official report on the battle at Ludlow that led to the Ludlow Massacre. I want to describe some of what that report said, first of all, and then place it in the context, place it in kind of historical context by using John R. Commons and what he had to say about new immigrants. John R. Commons was a labor economist, historian at the University of Wisconsin, and was very much a champion during his career of the American labor movement. And then I'll come back to the report for a bit more analysis. Let me describe first how this report came into existence in the first place. So in the aftermath of the Ludlow Massacre, the governor of Colorado kind of ordered an investigation of what had happened. And so he appointed three officers to a board of investigation. These men were named Major Edward Boughton, Captain William Danks, Captain Philip Van Size. But Danks and Edward Boughton were the ones who were sort of most responsible for writing this report. Both of them were lawyers in civilian life, and Boughton had been legal counsel for the Cripple Creek Miners Association. That association was very much instrumental in breaking a strike that had happened 10 years earlier by the Western Federation of Miners that happened in Cripple Creek and elsewhere in Colorado. Also a very violent strike. So you know, clearly he's got these kind of class, right, connections, right, to the mining industry. Boughton and Danks, however, did not write about class and class conflict in their explanation of what happened at Ludlow. Instead, you know, again, that they depicted strike duty and the battle at Ludlow as a contest that proved guardsmen to be both racially superior and at the same time kind of more manlier as well than their adversaries. Throughout the report, Boughton and Danks focused as much on the character of the people who resided in the Ludlow Tent Colony as on the killings that happened there. I'll read you some of what they said. They observed that the Southern and Eastern European immigrants, immigrant families at Ludlow had, quote, little in common with the few American residents among them. The percentage of American citizens, even naturalized citizens, was small. And it will readily be seen, they said, that these people did not possess much means of interchanging information or social ideas. Later in the report, Boughton and Danks described how Albert Martin, a private in the National Guard, was killed during the battle at Ludlow. He was the only member of the National Guard who was killed at Ludlow, aside from the two women and 11 children who were killed in this pit. There were seven more people kind of on the side of the miners who were killed at Ludlow. So 20 altogether on their side and one man on the side of the National Guard. So in describing in this report the condition of Albert Martin's body, basically they said that he had been mutilated, that the striking miners had mutilated him. They said that this act revealed, quote, the savage bloodlust of this Southern European peasantry. In their conclusion, these officers laid some blame for Ludlow on the coal mine operators, but only because they, quote, established an American industrial community. They established in an American industrial community a numerous class of ignorant, lawless, and savage Southern European peasants. The presence of such a community necessitated a state police force. Boughton and Danks concluded this new force would report for, quote, duty in disturbed regions of the state, whereby the young men of our volunteer National Guard may be relieved from engaging in riot duty with the people numbering among them ferocious foreigners whose savagery in fight we found exemplified in the maiming and mutilation of Private Martin. So the description that is in this report of the, kind of the condition of Alfred Martin's body differs from what the coroner had to say about it, the coroner's statement, the coroner's report. But it is probably true that a bullet fired from a gun of a striking miner wounded Private Martin, and it's certainly possible that the miners, when they found him, mutilated his body. At the same time, it's also true that Martin's death happened after months, right, of violent confrontations between Baldwin Feltz, deputy sheriffs and National Guard, guardsmen on one side, and striking miners and their families on the other. It's certainly true, too, that the miners often gave as good as they got in these confrontations, especially early on before the National Guard showed up, when the kind of adversary at that point was Baldwin Feltz. But, you know, the battle at Ludlow resulted in the destruction of the Ludlow Tent Colony, and that these violent deaths, along with the many preventable deaths in coal mine accidents that preceded the strike, at Colorado, this coal field in southern Colorado was particularly dangerous for reasons really tied to geology and climate, that the rate of death in these coal mines was between 2.5 and 3.5 times the national average in coal mining in the United States. And the US average was already high among industrialized countries. So you know, you kind of put that all together, right? And I think there's a kind of an alternative explanation, right, for the miners' own violence. Boughton and Danks' explanation for the strikers' treatment of Private Martin, however, obscured really what was class anger in favor of a racialized understanding of their adversaries. Describing the killing of Private Martin as savage certainly recalled the sensationalism that often characterized reports of Indian violence during the 19th century, Plains Indian Wars, indeed borrowing the language, right, of Western conquest to explain the world of industrial capitalism was a powerful tool, because it allowed the Guard to portray strikers as savage threats to Anglo-American civilization, a kind of threat that Anglo-Coloradans understood very well, given the recent history of the state. In this formulation, the miners' action was not attributable to class resentment growing out of the terrible conditions in which miners and their families worked and lived, but was instead explained by the fact, right, that these immigrant working class miners were, like the Plains Indians, racially inferior savages. Southern Colorado's coal miners certainly were not the first immigrants that native-born Americans thought of as savage. The equation of the increasingly immigrant working class with American Indians became common during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, as did the contention that new immigrants were racially inferior. This focus kind of reflected the increasing concern that many nativist intellectuals, physicians, journalists, academics voiced about the threat that Southern and Eastern European immigrants posed to Anglo-American civilization. So to get to John R. Commons, who spent his, I use him because he's kind of ironic, right, given that he spent his career kind of championing the rights of labor. wrote a book in 1907 called Races and Immigrants in America, which he argued that, quote, the peasant of Europe, especially of Southern and Eastern Europe, has been reduced to the qualities similar to those of an inferior race that favored despotism and oligarchy rather than democracy. Carman's also asserted that degeneracy among Southern and Eastern European immigrants would prevent them from thriving in the American political system. Commons wrote, quote, our democratic theories and forms of government were fashioned by but one of the many races and peoples, and that race, the so-called Anglo-Saxon, developed them out of its own insular experience, unhampered by inroads of alien stock. When thus established in England and further developed in America, we find that other races and peoples, accustomed to despotism and even savagery, and wholly unused to self-government, have been thrust into this delicate fabric, right? So that the coming, right, of these immigrants to the United States was destroying the democratic fabric of the country. It goes on to talk about how, like, kind of to keep these people in line, he says that that we have begun actually to despotize our institutions in order to control these dissonant elements. It's kind of an observation that could be read as a kind of not so veiled reference to the use of military force to crush the labor activism of immigrant workers. It, Commons was certainly an intellectual who was committed to democracy and was not consoled by the notion that the state would club racially inferior immigrants into submission. Instead, he worried that this creeping authoritarianism, quote, undermined the democratic ideals of native-born Americans and might ultimately destroy American democracy. It behooves us as a people, Commons concluded, to enter the practical study of this problem, for upon it, its outcomes depends the fate of government of the people, for the people, and by the people. Commons, as a member of the U.S. Immigration Commission, approved in 1911 that commission's 57-volume argument for restricting immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. Is certainly not alone in this. Fears about Southern and Eastern European immigrant workers who had lived in savagery for centuries, who were not endowed with the tools necessary for self-government, and were perceived as a cause of increasing labor unrest, was certainly widespread. Matthew Jacobson, in his book, Whiteness of a Different Color, points to men and women across the turn of the 20th century American political spectrum, from leftists like Margaret Sanger and Charlotte Perkins Gilman and Jack London to progressives like Woodrow Wilson, Edward Ross, Frederick Jackson Turner, and Theodore Roosevelt, to conservatives like Madison Grant and Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, all expressed ideas that overlapped and complemented the arguments that Commons made in his book, Races and Immigrants in America. Thus, I think it's clear that the idea that savagery was loose, right, among the immigrant working class had become commonplace. Among the nation's many nativists and proponents of immigration restriction, Antonio Gramsci's observation that, quote, for a social elite, the features of subordinate groups always display something barbaric or pathological is instructive here, I think. Commons and a whole host of other nativist thinkers used scientific racism, ideas culled from eugenic science, both of which had wide appeal at the turn of the 20th century, to argue that Southern and Eastern European immigrants were, as Gramsci would have it, barbaric and pathological. The form of their barbarity and their pathology, however, resembled something that Americans had seen before. By organizing themselves and violently resisting employer and state attempts to break their strikes, these immigrants, who spoke very little English often, were not Protestant, looked exotic, dressed oddly, ate strange foods, to some noses smelled funny, resembled the best example of a racially inferior but formidable enemy that the country had ever known, the American Indian. In this thinking, again, the Old West and the new scientific racism worked in tandem to explain the threat that these immigrants posed to the United States. Where are we on time, John?
You're fine.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Racially tinged ideas about masculinity also played an important part in how the Colorado National Guard explained and justified its actions at Ludlow. In their report, again going back to these two officers, Major Boughton and Captain Danks, they characterized the Greek men who lived in the Ludlow tent colony as aggressive fighting men who imposed their desire on the rest and were voracious and insistent upon giving battle to the soldiers at once if they should appear. The guards' uneasiness with the Greeks, with Greek miners, reflected the significant role that they played during the strike. Louis Tikas, a Greek immigrant who the guard actually murdered at Ludlow, was one of the other people who died at Ludlow. Tikas was instrumental in kind of maintaining the Ludlow tent colony. He was a leader in the tent colony. And Boughton and Danks referred to Tikas as the master of the tent city and asserted that, quote, the Greeks were regarded as heroes, for many of them, we are told, had served in the Balkan Wars. So Greece fought the First and Second Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913 against the Ottoman Turks first and then Bulgaria. And so these wars happened in 1912 and 13, so to think that a lot of veterans of these wars had made it to southern Colorado and into this tent colony. It's like these people were mobile, but not that mobile. there's a stretch, right, that's being made there. And it's a way, right, that for them to suggest, right, that they were not fighting, right? I mean, that this report was written after Ludlow. What Boughton and Danks were doing was by focusing on the Greeks was to suggest that they weren't fighting these women and children, that they're actually fighting these kind of formidable, right, male enemy who, like many guardsmen, had military combat experience. Lieutenant Carl Linderfelt, another guard officer, and Linderfelt was the most vicious of National Guard officers, was born and raised in Janesville, Wisconsin. So, in the course of this campaign is when Paul Ryan was chosen as vice president, at the time that Janesville would come up. I associate it with Carl Linderfelt. Linderfelt, another guard officer, followed a similar logic when he asserted that an Apache Indian belonging to the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, could not match what the Greeks and the Bulgarians had done to each other in the Balkans. An Apache Indian who was attached to the women's... So an Apache who wasn't a drunk, I suppose, right, capable of being particularly savage, I think is what he's saying. By insisting that the Greeks at Ludlow had previous combat experience, and in Linderfelt's case, highlighting the savagery of their actions in the Balkans, these National Guard officers attempted to evade responsibility for killing women and children, an act that they certainly considered to be unmanly, by casting the tent colony's Greek residents as fierce, savage, and masculine, right? A masculine foreign army that had invaded southern Colorado. this story about, you know, the savage and militaristic Greeks was also one that got told over and over again. It's not only in this report. It gets told in the state's newspapers. It gets told by mining companies as well. It's a story that they like as a way of explaining Ludlow. Residents of the tent colony, on the other hand, remembered only a few Balkan War veterans among them. Perhaps more importantly, the guard, the newspapers, the coal mining companies did not realize that Greek immigrants in the American West were often ambivalent about their country's involvement in the Balkan Wars and about military service in general. Many of these young men were in the United States because they were trying to avoid military service. This is the reason that they came, right, to the U.S. You know, some Greek Ludlow residents certainly had been members of the Greek military. There's certainly some evidence of that, and some of these men probably looked proudly on the success that their native land had enjoyed in the Balkan Wars, but that pride did not make them, did not make these men experienced combat soldiers. It was funny too in the, it's kind of more recent scholarship about this strike that both Scott Martell and Thomas Andrews have kind of, they've taken this story and kind of run with it. And I don't, to say, to kind of give the striking miners kind of more agency, that they were not victims, right? Only victims of the companies they worked for and of the National Guard. And just, I'm not sure how well that holds up. elsewhere in the report on Ludlow, Major Boughton and Captain Danks observed that, quote, "The Greeks were always warlike, and there were no Greek women or children in the colony." And this might have been a way of saying that, you know, that Ludlow was in fact an armed camp occupied by soldiers who kind of lacked the civilizing company of women and children, that the Greeks lacked wives and children in the New World, and so that they did not have domestic attachments, responsibilities that defined respectable middle-class native-born manhood. Also made these Greeks seem unmanly and uncivilized as well. In the same section of the report, Boughton and Danks also blamed not only the Greeks, but the striking miners generally for leaving their women and children behind in the utter chaos that reigned in the tent colony once fighting began. Charlie Costa, an Italian immigrant miner who was killed at Ludlow, told another colony resident as they ran past one another at the beginning of the battle at Ludlow, that it was his intention to lead his fellow miners out of the tent colony in an effort to draw the National Guard's fire away from the tent colony and away from the women and children still in the tents. Boughton and Danks, however, saw this retreating from the colony as a cowardly act. And seeing it as such allowed them to praise other National Guardsmen because they risked their lives rescuing, as they put it, these deluded people. As the battle raged around them. In doing so, Boughton and Danks sought to show that their fellow guardsmen were more manly than their adversaries in the tent colony. They wrote, quote, "We find that the work of rescuing these women and children was, under the circumstances, truly heroic and must stand out boldly in contradistinction to the abandonment of the helpless women and children by their own people." The officers, finally, lamented their comrades' inability to find the two women and 11 children who were killed when the fire consumed their tent. And it's, you know, this kind of willful ignorance here that they don't talk about, well, the machine gun fire, right? For instance, that the National Guard was directing into the tent colony on this day. Okay, so the attributes of the enemy guardsmen created in their public comments on the strike, they certainly were not complete fabrications. It is likely that the striking miners mutilated in some way Private Martin's body after they killed him. A few Greek Balkan War veterans were present in the Ludlow tent colony, and those Greeks, along with other immigrant men who lived at Ludlow, did leave the colony with their women and children during the battle. And some National Guardsmen did work to get women and children out of the Ludlow tents, even as other guardsmen were setting them on fire. Colorado National Guard used these facts to attack all of these people with words and with weapons because they challenged the guard's sense of masculine, racial, and class dominance as well. The striking miners at Ludlow, Greek and otherwise, were on strike, took up arms against the National Guard, commanded by Colorado's native-born white middle and upper class. Seen in this light, the Greek men at Ludlow did not appear dangerous solely because guardsmen believed that they were Balkan War veterans. They appeared dangerous because they were strangers in Colorado who dared to challenge their betters and the National Guard, built tents, bought weapons, ignored the guard's authority as the enforcer of the state's will, refused to end their strike no matter how brutally the guard treated them. They also appeared dangerous because they were desperate, and their desperation only grew as they toughed out a Colorado winter living in tents. It's no coincidence that the Ludlow Massacre happened in the early spring of 1914, again after the relationship between the Guard and striking miners had become increasingly poisoned over the course of a long winter. How guardsmen understood the immigrant working class they faced on strike duty also tells us much, I think, about the Colorado National Guard. Now, on one level, it's useful to think of the Guard as a modern institution, the spawn of the kind of unholy union between the modern state and modern industrial capitalism. Colorado National Guard, however, did not talk, write, and think, you know, entirely in the terms of class and class conflict that was central to the battle between labor and capital at the turn of the 20th century. In this report that I've been describing on Ludlow, the Guard kind of obscured class in favor of race and gender, and thus invoked not the modern industrial world, but again, the West's sort of romantic past. By continually inserting that the white man's masculine superiority over Ludlow's Greek residents, while equating the striking immigrant miners with the savage plains Indians, and the Guard cast strike duty as, a kind of a continuation of frontier efforts to defend the civilization that white settlers had brought to the American West. Colorado National Guard's efforts to explain their actions in this way did something indispensable, I think, for Southern Colorado's mine operators. They helped to remove strike breaking from the realm of the battle between capital and labor and placed it in a broad discourse about Anglo-American empire. Many Coloradans, many Americans, at the turn of the 20th century were certainly uncomfortable with the power and influence that capital had accrued in every aspect of national life, but they were also, at the same time, just as uncomfortable with the massive number of immigrants who were streaming into the country's mills, mines, and factories. By making strike breaking about defeating an alien and racially inferior enemy that was invading the country, rather than having strike breaking be about protecting capital's interests, the National Guard invoked what made the United States great in the minds of so many, its conquest of the North American continent. The kind of saying is that it's not about protecting the interests of capital, right? It's about maintaining what we all, right, the native born, had built. Indeed, I think that the belief that immigrant working class labor militancy posed, I think that the belief that that immigrant working class labor militancy posed a dire threat to white native-born supremacy over the North American continent helps explain why turn of the 20th century labor conflicts like this strike, like the 1913 Southern Colorado coal strike, were so violent and so often defeated with military force. The challenge that these workers posed to the established economic, political, social order convinced many Americans that nothing less than kind of Anglo-American civilization was at stake. Thanks.
So we're going to try something new this time around.
Because the fact that we've had a request from the library that we actually mic questions so that that they can actually record them better and digitize them and all that. Well, thank you so much for the presentation. I've got a number of questions, but I'm sure other people do as well. Let me just hit you with one while I stand up and go find people. This whole idea of the West being different, what you're really, you've got indigenous people, in this case you're saying that, you know, the Greeks and Eastern Europeans in that way. And the lawlessness makes them also outlaws. I mean, so that you've actually got both the Native Americans on the one side and the traditional kind of Western outlaw on the other, metaphorically, then, that you're really playing with in terms of the idea of trying to establish law and order. Does that make sense in terms of what you're raising?
Yeah, you know, there is, I'm not sure, Johnny, how to use this yet, but there's this history of the National Guard written by a guy named John Nankerville, who was an officer, served during this strike, and he pulls out of a book called The Pilgrim and the Pioneer, written by, let's get his name, John C. Bell, kind of fictional account of this guy, it's kind of thinly veiled autobiography. This guy coming, Bell coming from Tennessee to Colorado and joining the National Guard. And it's early on, this is in the 1870s and 80s, that he gets called out on strike duty. And there's this whole kind of intrigue going on in which somebody, kind of political opponent of the mayor of the town, is accused of raping, I think, a woman who was known to the striking miners, and so they want to lynch this guy. And they're able to do so. And so Bell in the book is kind of lamenting that as a guardsman, right, that he was unable to stop this from happening, right? That he was unable to stop this lawlessness, right? And it goes on as a kind of a redemption story, right, in which then he is able to kind of assert his manhood, really. And it's kind of this other set of events that happens with these striking miners, right? That he is able to kind of, to assert his manhood, his masculinity, and to kind of lead the members of his company in stopping, I can't recall off the top of my head right now, to stop these striking miners from doing something else that lawless, you know? And that Nankerville, as kind of a historian of the National Guard and somebody who served during this strike, that he chose to include, it kind of takes it verbatim out of the book and sticks it into his history. I think there's a kind of significance there that sort of gets to, you know, what you're thinking about here. That they kind of see themselves, right, and that Nankerville kind of saw the Guard as this, you know, kind of way of that its duty, right, was to kind of enforce law and order, right, and to deal with this kind of lawlessness. It kind of takes on a different character, I think you're saying, with the coming of these new immigrants, right, to Southern Colorado or to Colorado more generally. And that lawlessness then has, I don't know, it's kind of a different character in the context of, you know, not the Wild West, right, but of industrial capitalism, right?
Well, just to point out, many people might know the quote, Big Bill Haywood, one of the leaders of the Western Federation of Miners, used to stand up in New York City. It was a very famous speech where he said, I'm a two-gun man from the wild, wild west, and he pulled out his Socialist Party card and his IWW card.
So okay.
this kind of notion, wrapping themselves, the Western Federation of Miners, you know, a very, very violent union in the West. So this kind of feeling of lawlessness, I mean, outlaw culture, we have a tendency to now look at Jesse James or a lot of other people in that same era as outlaws. Well, you know, after the turn of the 20th century, outlaws were, you know, they became gangsters a little bit later.
Right.
But I think that you're really saying that they're trying to bury the Old West, they're trying to bury the Native American that now are Greek. And they're also trying to perhaps bury the outlaws who are now lawless strikers. But I'm just trying to kind of play metaphorically with where you're going.
Okay, right. So it's kind of way of characterizing it is that this is a continuation of the kind of the mission of lawmen in the Old West. Okay, all right.
So let me hand the microphone over to, raise your hand, and I'd be happy to hand you the mic. Over to Dorothy.
Hi, I've been listening to you speaking, and you're trying to describe rationally the behavior of the various groups here. And here we are in this particular time, and men coming back from war in Afghanistan or somewhere are described with something called post-traumatic stress syndrome. Now that's a new thing. It doesn't sound terribly rational the way these men are behaving. So my question for you is, in your specialty academically, Is it customary ever to bring into the discussion the fact that some of these people are very disturbed by what they've been through?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, right? Because there are a number of these people, officers in particular, and Carl Linderfeld probably most among them, who, that if they weren't in the military, I don't know how well they could have gotten along, right, in kind of civilized, organized society. That there's a kind of sociopathic quality to a number, right, of these people. Okay.
About a year ago, in the middle of winter, walking toward this campus, which was deserted, a young man came up to me, and he said, "I'm in the National Guard, and I need to find the Union." And he was walking in the reverse direction, away from the Union.
Uh-huh.
And he was from a small town in Michigan. He'd never been on a college campus before. He had been his unit was deployed to, we'll say, Afghanistan or somewhere, and at the last minute it was canceled. So he had to decide what to do. And so he decided to go look at a college campus, and here he was all alone.
Uh-huh.
He was very suspicious when I directed him toward the Union. That I was some sort of phony, you know. But I got him there, and then he was very happy. So you could go back 100 or more years, whatever, but you still have these, I won't say he was disturbed, but very anxiety-ridden mm-hmm. about the situation.
Let me just rewrap for you. Uh-huh. Part of where I think where Dorothy was coming from, but in relation to your answer, because these were National Guardsmen, which is not their day job then. I mean, the head of the National Guard in the 1913 copper strike, Roy Vandercook, was from Owosso, if I remember rightly, and I think that he ran a retail outlet or whatever. Uh-huh. So, I mean, they're called up as National Guardsmen so in that way, they're playing soldier. They're not necessarily, some cases they're ex-soldiers, but in a lot of cases these guys have never been active military.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's only the adjutant general, who's kind of it's a full-time job, and there might have been a couple of people right around him who, but yeah, you're right that they're they have civilian lives and civilian jobs, and this was sort of an outlet, right, for this kind of darker part of their personality, you know, that John Chase, who was the adjutant general of the Colorado National Guard, he was an optometrist in civilian life, people writing about him and talking about him that had like kind of warm feelings about him, that he was a good doctor, that he cared about his patients and so forth, people who went to see him. But on the other side, he kind of made his bones, I guess you could say, in the National Guard, helping to break the 1903-1904 Western Federation of Miners strike. And he did that as a commander in ways that, you know, broke every rule of the National Guard and broke every law that you could break, right? in the course of breaking a strike. The adjutant general at that time was a guy named Sherman Bell, and Sherman Bell had been a rough rider with Theodore Roosevelt. And Sherman Bell, I think, was certifiably crazy. I mean, he was the amount of vitriol, first of all, that he expressed, you know, toward the Union and what he was willing to do in order to break that strike. I mean, he was, again, you know, that if you put this person in some other capacity in society, right, that they, how well they can function there, right? I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, I do think that there's this way in which that this military service is, yeah, they're definitely playing soldier, there's that going on, but it's this, they're sort of acting out this fantasy as well. And it's a way of kind of, you know, acting out the fantasy that is based in the hatred that they have for these people. And there's a kind of, you know, a sort of ambivalence about it as well, that they see occupying the class that they did, the advantages of having cheap labor, right? But they also, the kind of language that they use elsewhere is about cleaning out Ludlow, right? Cleaning out Trinidad. Yeah, it's this language of like these people are kind of a stain on the landscape, right? That they need to be cleaned out. And this kind of language is a book called Male Fantasies by author's name is Klaus Thewaite, talking about the Free Corps in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, and he plays really fast and loose with his sources. But there's this like that they are fantasizing as well, right? That these men are kind of fantasizing about violence and using violence against people, against Jews, right? And communists in Germany, who they see in this sort of same way, and they that the Free Corps came from the same class position as well. It's kind of out of middle class. Kind of some business owners and professionals, that they look very much like what the officer corps and the National Guards in the United States looked like.
Okay.
While he's here. Okay. I particularly want to thank you for this talk. In 1999, the summer of 1999, my daughter was one of the diggers in the archaeological work done at Ludlow, and when she told me what she was going to do and what it was about, I was kind of astonished because I had never heard of the Colorado Coalfield Wars. They didn't teach that when I went to school. But I had two things to go to. One was, you seem to be struggling with the image of the Apache Indian in the WCTU.
Right, yeah, uh-huh.
Picture Carrie Nation in loincloth leggings and a war bonnet, and I think you'll have what he was trying to go with.
Say it again?
Carrie Nation,
uh-huh, right,
the lady
yeah.
who smashed
right.
up saloons.
Right.
Yeah, I think
uh-huh.
that's what he was... With a tomahawk, yes.
Okay,
I think
right.
that I think that's what he was going
okay,
for.
All right. Okay, all right.
And the other thing is, you cited, 24 different languages spoken in the Ludlow tent
yeah.
colony.
Mm-hmm.
Does this reflect something that I know the steel mill owners used to do in Pittsburgh, which was to actively recruit from different European countries so that the workers could not talk to each other and organize?
Yeah, that's exactly what was
so
going
they
on
deliberately
yeah.
brought in
yeah.
people who would be
and,
have
yeah.
a harder time
and like in Pittsburgh and in Homestead that there's this change that happens in the mining workforce in the 1880s and 90s from kind of native-born Americans and kind of more Scottish, Welsh, English, Irish immigrants, right? And it kind of like maybe first or second generation removed from that immigration experience, from that mining workforce to more and more Southern Eastern European and Mexican as well.
Of course, the Irish only became respectable when the
Italians. Right. It's like these people
now, let me point
so
out
much
that
worse.
If George
right.
McGovern had become president, we would have been reading his book on the Colorado coal strikes. And that way, we all would know more about it, perhaps. But one of those lost moments.
The funny thing, that was his, George McGovern did a PhD in history at Northwestern in the early 1950s. He wrote his dissertation about this strike. And so the book called The Great Caulfield War was his campaign book in 1972. He turned it into a book with the help of Leonard Guthridge. And so this is like how much American politics has changed. I mean, like, yes, he got landslide defeat, but to have your campaign book be this kind of pro labor, very sympathetic to labor, right? Book is just hard to imagine.
Right? And why he didn't run, therefore, as Dr. George McGovern is another question. But I guess that Senator somehow is a little higher on the pecking order. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I kind of. Yeah.
Okay. they need to record you.
I'm kind of curious because the National Guard probably is not reformed almost up until Vietnam. In other words, in the Flint strike, for example, the same model, the officers came out of World War I, a lot of them. So did the troops, but there was a definite class distinction. And in fact, if it hadn't been for the governor in Michigan, the officer corps would have shot the guys out of the plant. That was
right,
very
yeah,
clear.
He, right, this kind of,
the guys themselves were in
yeah.
the, still in the National Guard, probably to pick up that little paycheck like my father was in the 30s. And I happened to have been called up in 1960 when the Berlin Wall went up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mess. It was an absolute disaster. If you remember, there was a pamphlet that was published and it said, "Why me?" It's because the roads, in the, especially the eastern part of the United States, were littered with National Guard equipment, which hadn't changed or been kept up or maintained since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The guys were poorly trained. They were abysmal. I mean, it was just in terms of their training and so on. And it was after that that it became much more professionalized and so on. So we see today, for example, in Afghanistan, the Guard is being called up multiple times because, of course, there's no draft. And so that this professionalization, forget what it's doing to the individuals, which
right.
is atrocious. Mm-hmm. But I think this National Guard model has been ongoing for quite some time. The second part of what I'm interested in is, do you have any, you know, the guys that are left out of the history books, even within the National Guard, and that is the rank and file. Any, because I imagine that their ideas are somewhat different. Yes, the racial thing and all the
yeah.
rest of it, but reluctant.
Unfortunately, there isn't much. I've done in a statistical sample database that gives me a kind of sociological profile of the enlisted ranks that comes from the rosters, right? And so, you know, yeah, the enlisted men, you know, came from kind of much more of a cross section of the population of Colorado, that you get a lot more working class men. I think, though, at the same time, by the time this strike happens, that if you lived in Colorado and paid any attention to what was happening around you, that if you joined the Colorado National Guard, you'd kind of go into it with an understanding that you might be, it was likely, right, that you were going to be called on to do this, right, to engage in strike breaking. And so in that way, it's the kind of like self-selection, you know, going on. It's kind of men who would be willing to do this who joined up. That is, at the same time, though, is speculation. I can't say that I can point to a piece of evidence that shows me this. However, the National Guard did intentionally recruit heavily in rural areas of Colorado. And they did so, they're explicit about this, they did so because they thought that farm boys, right, would be more willing to do strike breaking.
And they needed a paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, right? Yeah, that, you know, you need the extra money. There's one officer who, there's a collection in the Denver Public Library, the correspondence between, he's a captain, so he's the commanding officer of a company, and there's a great deal of correspondence between him and his lieutenants and him and his enlisted men. But what they talk about in that correspondence during the strike, between the officers and the enlisted men, you could not tell that there was a strike. That you can't tell from the correspondence what they were doing. I need more underwear. I need more socks. I need to go home this weekend. It's like this kind of, like, you know, really, you know, ordinary, you know, day-to-day stuff. They're not. It's only among the officers that they're talking about strategy and what they're doing and how strike breaking gets carried out. It's hard to get at with the enlisted men.
Well, we're over time, but why don't we give Anthony one more round of applause?
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Do come next Friday, but we're over at the library next Friday. And if you have other questions, do grab him before he gets out the door. But thanks for coming.
Thank you for coming. It's something that evolves, really. It's to point to a date, right, that there are, Pennsylvania is the first one, and that is in the aftermath of 1877, but Pennsylvania was atypical in that it already had, that its militias, right, go back to 1792, that its militias were actually much more well organized. And so that in Pennsylvania, they're kind of more able to quickly, right, establish a National Guard. And so going forward from 1877, kind of states do this a little bit at a time. By 1903, however, every state that's a state in 1903 had one. In the South, and it's kind of one maybe positive for the National Guards in this period. In the South, there were occasions where Southern governors called out their National Guards to prevent lynchings, to stop lynchings. But yeah, it's something that kind of happens first in the industrialized states, and then it kind of spreads every place else. 1903, that it becomes a federal, the kind of formal reserve force for the army. They say by 1900, across the country, there were 100,000 men under arms in the National Guard. So you take all the National Guards together. The army at the time was only 25,000. So it's like this massive, really massive military presence that don't necessarily recognize. And it's too that I mean, I think this is what's going on there as well. Is you can think about the early 19th century and the sort of suspicion, right? Strong suspicion that there was of having any kind of standing army, having troops, right, inside of the country coming out of the revolution, and the way that the kind of privileges that the British Army enjoyed in the colonies, to go from that sort of suspicion and thinking about the military as kind of an engine of despotism to, a bunch of decades later, after, in the midst of the Second Industrial Revolution, to having this kind of military presence and that it's tolerated, right? That, yeah.
Bear in mind that Michigan, and maybe
Yeah, there is this, it goes from, okay, the National Guards for strike breaking to the state police, right? That Pennsylvania's kind of an innovator in this, the creation of oppressive state bodies, right?